Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Monday, May 20th, and good heavens, there is no way you're going to hear this show today. I'm not going to post it today. The internet is a disaster from what I've seen so far. I don't know what it is. If you're listening to this at some point in the future, you should know that this is the day after the series finale of Game of Thrones. And I don't know what it is about this show that just brings out the worst in people. Maybe it's all the stabbing or the incest or the zombies or people being burned alive. There's lots of things that are potentially triggering about this show. So when I say the worst in people, there's this incredible sense of entitlement about – and this is nothing new. I mean, it's gotten really bad during this final season, season 8. But this is a problem that's been going on for years where people feel – a lot of people feel like they deserve a better show than what they've gotten. And they're really upset about many twists and turns in the plots, favorite characters. Now, we're going to talk about all of this in a minute. Let me tell you a little bit about what's happening on the show. I just knew this show didn't stand a chance of making it into most people's queues or even becoming visible on Facebook or Twitter, on Instagram, if I posted it today. So I'm going to release this on Tuesday, the 21st. It was actually recorded a couple weeks ago. It is with Dr. Duke Pesta, somebody that I first heard about, say, it might have been last summer, the beginning of this school year. Dr. Pesta is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. He put out a contract for his students to sign at the beginning of the year. I ask him about this at the beginning of the conversation. It just really lights a fuse for both of us. And most of our entire discussion, which was actually limited to 45 minutes, unfortunately, is related to Dr. Pesta's answer to this prompt, really, about the contract. The highlights of this contract, Dr. Pesta asked his students to sign. In this course, we study literature from cultures that existed before you were born. Their world is not our world. Their beliefs may not be our beliefs. No one asks you to believe or endorse any premise, attitude, precept, theology, political system, or ideology contained in these books or expressed in class. Nor will you ever lose points or be docked grades because of your opinion. He urges students to not judge some of the great writers of history by progressive standards and values of today. Contract goes on to say, we will not malign or trivialize these texts because they do not always parrot our values. Hold on your hats for this part. We will not assume that these books are racist, sexist, or homophobic because of the period in which they were written or because of the race, class, gender, or religion of the authors. As you're going to learn today, maybe you're not going to learn this today, but it's certainly going to be reinforced. This kind of scrutiny and call-out culture, the term coined by NYU professor Jonathan Haidt, where people basically try to collect social brownie points by instead of like going to a professor and saying, hey, this thing happened in class and it made me uncomfortable, they do it publicly. They might never even have the one-on-one conversation with the professor about the thing that they had a problem with. And a lot of the things you'll hear about this today, things people are having problems with in these types of classes, very, very questionable. The act of the call out is much more of a priority than resolving the issue itself, if there really is even a real issue in some of these cases to resolve. He also urges that anyone triggered by, quote, open, direct, adult discussion of issues, including but not limited to issues of faith, war, violence, race, gender, and sexuality, should drop the class. So this was, like I said, the beginning of this school year. I wanted to know if there's any fallout from the contract when he first issued it and how this went for him over the last year of school. So I'm talking to Duke now. because we're both going to be attending this Red Pill conference in a couple of weeks. It's June 7th through the 9th. It's called the Red Pill Expo. And you can get more information about that at redpillexpo.org. And I'm hoping while we're there, we can have a longer conversation because the time limit that we had to work with, I mean, this was like we recorded this a couple weeks ago. It was probably right at the end of the school year for him, prevented us from being able to pursue certain avenues of the conversation. We do devote some time to the leveling of the playing field, so to speak, in education. It mirrors an argument that I've made in the past about the changing messaging of the left, how standards are being reduced, goalposts are being moved as far as educational achievement is concerned to bring everybody to the same place, right? Even if that means bringing some people down. When we were doing shows about, you know, social justice and identity politics a couple years ago, my argument against terms like privilege was, you know, 50 years ago, the left's message was about, at least on the surface anyway, their message was about uplift. Like, how can we lift people up who are disadvantaged? And here we are, you know, a half a century after the implementation of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs. And, you know, it's pretty like quantifiably conclusive that those programs didn't work. So the language has changed from uplift to knock down, right? Be aware of your privilege. So we see this whole rise of intersectionality and how can you do penance for your privilege? How can you apologize for your privilege? How do you deal with the guilt that you should feel about your privilege? And of course, implied in all of that, and it will become more explicit, I think, in the near future. What are you willing to pay, you know, to relieve yourself of this guilt related to this unfair position from which you started your life? Now, is that a fact? Does anybody deny that some people start life in better positions, or as we go through life, as we go through the professional world, some of us, for unearned reasons, are in better positions than others to get ahead? I don't think that's really debatable. Privilege is not, and this is the sort of subtext of so many progressive ideas and talking points. It's not a bridge building word. It is alienating language, and it is politicizing. And when things are politicized, they're ruined. And this is almost like an effort to politicize empathy because, you know, even people who start life in better positions, they still go through life immersed in their own unique problems and struggles. In the presentation of the idea that, oh, you have nothing to complain about, which is, you know, that might not be explicit, but it's implied. It's really disconnecting. But privilege is about knockdown because uplift failed in this faith-based pursuit of equality. Now, equality for so many of these people is just a floating conclusion. There aren't even premises underneath it to check. And I'm in this Facebook group. Somebody posts this meme. It's like a Bernie 2020 meme about charter schools. And it's like charter schools are the new form of segregation because – get this, 17% of charter schools have 99% plus minority population. Now, there's so many questions to ask right there. Where are these charter schools? Who are they set up for? What's their mission statement? Who do they want to serve? But, you know, if Bernie supporters ask follow-up questions, there wouldn't be such a thing as Bernie supporters. So this is a Bernie 2020 meme. We're going to solve this problem of inequality. And I see this, and I just chime in. I'm not trying to start trouble. I'm just making conversation. I say, which is better, forced integration or voluntary segregation? Defend your answer. And this is not the first time I've asked a question like this on one of these subjects, but the responses are predictable. LOL, number one. Number two, there's like several versions of number two, which essentially boils down to, I won't even dignify that with a response, which is a go-to escape hatch for many progressives and lefties. Or number three, I can't even. Of course you can't. Can, could, those things require thought. Because this idea of equality is clutched so tightly by the institutional left, right? In the media, politics, academia, they're never letting go. The faith is so strong in this concept that the messaging will just be adjusted. It's true in education. How will we sacrifice the top to bring up the bottom? You know, what I saw happening in the way the left talks about social issues, it was very interesting to hear Dr. Pesta, a college professor, observing a lot of the same impulses in educational policy. One thing that did not happen in this discussion that I would have liked to have happened, but we just didn't have time. Dr. Pesta was an author of a book in 2016 called The Renaissance and the Postmodern, A Study in Comparative Critical Values. And Dr. Pesta is a huge critic of the whole postmodern project. And we talk about a couple of the big names, Foucault and Derrida. And I shouldn't say we talk about them, right? I mentioned their names. And when Stephen Hicks was on the show, I said, okay, defend them, steel man them, step into their shoes, come up with the most positive conception you can of what they were trying to do. Because it's become very easy and very popular to talk about these figures in a way like they were trying to undermine the West. Sure, that's become a feature or maybe a benefit for angry embracers of postmodernism. But is that what it's really all about? Was that the intentions of these people? I want to understand these people better. And because I didn't get as developed as I'd like, I actually was talking to a friend of the show, Nick Ulbrich, the man I traveled across the country with in 11 days, a year and a half ago. And he, of course, Nick has been on the show before. He's very, very knowledgeable about Foucault. And I feel like there's an interesting challenge that I would like to dig into on this show. So at some point in the future, Nick and I will do a long form conversation about the work of Michel Foucault. And I don't want to do that because I'm interested in becoming a postmodernist. I'm really just interested in the challenge of stepping into the le chapeau of people like Foucault. That's French for shoes. So other than that, I'm also trying to be more careful about the tone of certain shows. I don't want the main thrust of a conversation to be kids suck now. And there's lots of external factors that I think that are contributing to an emotional health crisis in young people. And I've tried in recent shows to do a better job of empathizing with this. It's just, I guess, a feature of getting old. Maybe that if you're not conscious of what you're doing, you develop more antagonistic mindset about younger generations. But in the last 2 years, this is definitely a group of people that has dealt with too much input. I know that sounds cliche, but if you're my age, even as the internet really expanded during the time I was in college, it felt like we were kind of slowly introduced to the world. We're just coming off a big investigation of the president of the United States. And when I've had some free time, like I've tried to come to understand the whole Russiagate thing, really, if anything, just as a source of entertainment. And you encounter such an incredible amount of noise. You know, I compare it to 1999, when a president was under a similar type of scrutiny and investigation, President Clinton. It seemed like even for somebody who had far less interest or knowledge about politics, me at that time, I remember it just feeling like a manageable amount of input because we were talking about it a lot I was taking a 20th century history class and we were talking about it like quite a bit. But today there's so much noise, so much clutter. I understand the impulse that a lot of young people would have, especially considering how they're schooled and about how associating learning with boredom can give people a lazy stance when it comes to the prospect of learning new things, especially if new things are difficult. I think so many of us can probably identify with that. I certainly can. But the response is just give me the answer. Bonus points if it makes me feel like I'm smart or responsible or sophisticated. And, college professors are lining up to provide young, frustrated, overwhelmed adults with that very experience. So Duke and I recorded this show a couple of weeks ago. And it's ironic that it's coming out this week. You know, that I'm recording this the day after the conclusion of the whole Game of Thrones series. I'm going to be talking with somebody who teaches Shakespeare. And if you've read a lot of Shakespeare, you can probably see a number of parallels between those two worlds. But it also, you know, as I'm looking at the fallout, I'm looking at the response to last season of Game of Thrones, it's kind of an interesting checkpoint in just some of the changes in the public conversation just over like the last decade, right? So about 10 years ago, HBO was wrapping up my second favorite HBO show of all time, The Sopranos. And I remember people feeling unsatisfied with the way the show concluded. And if you've never seen The Sopranos, it's a show about a gangster who, you know, has some issues with depression, and the show makes a continuous effort to like pull you in and push you away. Like if you're invested, you really get jerked around by the show. And what I mean by that is it humanizes him and then pounds you with how monstrous some of his actions can be. And a lot of people hated the end of the show. I thought it was brilliant. In the final episode, there's a scene where he's meeting his family in like a little diner, little family restaurant. And it's filmed with this tension where you feel like there's about to be a hit, like someone's going to come into the restaurant or come out of the bathroom, Godfather Part One style, and shoot Tony. In the final moments of the show, and there's a close-up on Tony sitting at the table looking at the menu, and you hear the front door of the restaurant open, and he looks up, and the show just cuts, right? There's no dissolve out. There's no fade to black. There's no resolution. It just cuts, and then the credits. Well, wait a minute. I want to know what happened to Tony. And the message from the creators of the show is like, oh, wait, why do you care about a psychopath? Why do you care about this monster? Why do you care about this criminal? The deprivation of knowing how Tony's story ends is like a very confronting sort of interactive exercise in the show. And I loved it. I thought that was brilliant. And I say, like, how could that have ended better? There were fewer places to talk about things like this back then, but I remember people, you know, feeling kind of upset about it, feeling kind of cheated even by this lack of a resolution to the story that they had become so invested in. And I'm to the point of this story, like I said, not trying to punch down at kids and say, oh, in the good old days, we were so mature about the way a television show ended when we if we didn't like it. It's just an interesting thing to consider that today Game of Thrones ends, lots of people are unsatisfied with it, and there is a petition, 1 million signatures strong, demanding that the show be remade. That there is a petition that basically says, no, do it again, I deserve better. I don't think that's specifically a generational thing. I think it's more of an internet echo chamber thing. So I encounter this piece of information, and I know I'm putting out this show, and I know I'm looking for tie-ins to the conversation that I have a talk with Dr. Pessa. So I say to myself, don't do the most obvious thing. Don't go, oh, look at how entitled kids are today. They think that, the television show should be remade. They don't. I'm sorry. What a perfect example of the downfall of Western Civ. Don't do that, I said to myself. So I went and I started reading, trying to put myself in the zapatos. That's the Spanish word for shoes. Put myself in the shoes of the signers of this petition. Now, the reasons people can sign the petition and then they can comment on why they signed the petition. Some people write very long, heartfelt essays. Some people are upset with what characters died. Lots of people who apparently never had an honest conversation with themselves about the nature of power, really upset about the turn for the Daenerys Targaryen character, even though that was foreshadowed for 8 seasons. But there was an interesting tie-in because George R.R. Martin, because these kinds of complaints or this sense of entitlement or I deserve a better show because I pay $15 a month for HBO or whatever, or I spent $700 on a Robert Baratheon costume to go to some con. Criticisms, especially of things like characters being killed off, is nothing new. In fact, George R.R. Martin, the writer of Song of Ice and Fire, on which Game of Thrones is based, you know, was speaking out publicly about this like 5 years ago. Because the response Martin was addressing 5 years ago, it wasn't to the Song of Ice and Fire book series. It was to the television show Game of Thrones. When people get upset about like Ned Stark dying or the Ned Stark dies or the Red Wedding, but a lot of the Starks die. His take on it, Martin's take on it was like, hey, maybe you people should read more. You know, like, have you ever heard of William Shakespeare? Have you ever read Hamlet? If you had read Hamlet, for example, you might learn to not get so attached to people. Or as far as like Daenerys's character arc, like you might want to see how her story plays out before you decide to name your daughter after her. But it's interesting. I didn't tell Dr. Pesta this, but I'm no Shakespeare fan because I was force-fed it in high school with no explanation of why it was valuable or how much it shaped literature in the Western world. It wasn't until I was like maybe 31, you know, like around the time I started the show, that I read Hamlet and I did it with a student. And I remember going into it, like I was tutoring this kid in English, dreading it because I remember the experience. But I was like, oh, you know, this is pretty cool. This is pretty neat. This is actually pretty great. I think I even talked about this like very early on in the show, having a really antagonistic relationship, using Shakespeare as an example of something that school did wrong. Kids are, you know, they have this coercive relationship with William Shakespeare and that ruins it. And that's really unfortunate. You know, the point is that I'm reading through a lot of the reactions that led to people taking to the streets you know, against the Game of Thrones television series, as if like they were expecting this to be more like Seinfeld or Friends or something. The one thing that I did see, and it's actually right in the title of the petition, that it is hard to disagree with, is that the writing could have been way better. I will say this, and I know some of you are saying, oh, great, just what the world needs more of, some ordinary guy's opinions on Game of Thrones. I enjoy your sarcasm, and I promise I will try to make this quick. So, you know, as I was watching the last three or four episodes, I was actually, several times, I was reminded of the Paul Thomas Anderson film Boogie Nights. Now, just stay with me, okay? Boogie Nights is a film that came out like maybe 1998, 1999, and it's about the adult entertainment industry from maybe like the mid-70s to the mid-80s. Later on in the film, the characters embrace this very self-aggrandized notion that they can work meaningful plots into sex films. And Anderson plays this creative process up on screen for comedic effect. So they develop this character named Brock Landers, right, who's like a detective or a PI or something. It's not – I don't even know if it's really clear. They show the behind the scenes of like they're making the Brock Landers movie, and, you know, the direction is like, okay, Brock goes into the bar and there's the woman who had her jewels stolen, and this is the part where they find out her ex-husband was the one who conspired with her current husband to steal them. And now she's a woman scorned, and that drives the plot to the point where the sex scene takes place. And what it is, and I made that up, right? But that's kind of a capture of how it works in the film, right? Where every one of these cues from the director is minimal amount of creative effort needed to move the plot forward, right? Like, this is a thing that has to happen to get to the part where there's sex, right? And in this analogy, like, the sex is these two showrunners for Game of Thrones going on to work on the next Star Wars project. So a lot of things that people developed a lot of anticipation around are very rushed to their conclusions over these last few episodes. And that's a fair criticism, especially when you consider the motivations of the showrunners. But I find it interesting that in 10 years of this, you know, the 10 years later, 10 years after the end of The Sopranos, with the rise of internet echo chambers and call-out culture and social justice, the tone of person responds to unsatisfying conclusion to TV show has gone from I feel disappointed to I am a victim demanding justice. And I understand there's 350 million people in the United States, slightly over a million people signed this petition. But let's remember, only 15 million people watch Game of Thrones. So that number is pretty significant. So then the question is, just kind of looking at this in the context of the whole political, social conversation happening out there, is there anything constructive about this petition? Because if any of these people thought carefully and honestly about this for like 3 minutes, they'd realize what they're asking is impossible. Principal cast is already ready to move on. Most of them are probably tired of this, and they're ready to move on to new projects they've already committed to. It would take 5 minutes of thought to realize the impossibility of this. But that's not what it's about, right? It's a call out. It's a call out. And yeah, it's a bummer. I love the show. I was satisfied with the way it ended. But as I think I mentioned early, yeah, it did have a kind of late 70s, early 80s adult film contrived plot rush feel to it. But so much of the disappointment relates to like, I didn't want this person to die. I didn't want that to happen to this character. And in that case, I agree with George R.R. Martin's advice. And I wish I had had this experience when I was younger. It existed in some form in school, even though it was poorly delivered, and it certainly existed in some form in higher education. And as time goes on, it's becoming less and less the case for college students because this stuff is being removed. And I'm not saying that this is like the end-all be-all for, you know, a young scholar in pursuit of knowledge, but it's at least very useful in seeing how one brilliant mind responds to another, which there is a lot of in this canon of literature. But I went out into the world of ideas without this, so stop me when this sounds familiar, I would encounter
a set of beliefs, an ideology. And I would say, well, these must be the best ideas because I had so little to compare it to. And maybe that's not familiar to you, but it certainly is in what we see in so much of the world today in higher education. And I think a lot of this almost anti-intellectual, anti-West climate in higher education bears a lot of the blame for that. And we're going to talk about that on the show today. Of course, here's my conversation with Duke Pesta, already in progress. We're talking here about his presentation coming up at the Red Pill Expo. Thank you so much for listening. Here we go.
My primary job is the last 25 years, I've been a professor of English. I'm an English professor, humanities professor. I've taught at 7 different universities, including big ones and smaller ones. And so I have a kind of unique position. I'm the only non-progressive English professor I think I've ever met. Hmm. And so my talk for the Red Pill is going to be about how colleges and universities are actually using the power they have over our kids' minds to undermine the Republic, how they are anti-free market, these universities, they are pro-socialist, they are collectivist, they are globalist, and to watch the role that universities play in pulling apart our national fabric, intentionally keeping kids ignorant of our history and culture, making them constitutionally illiterate, breeding generations of students who are entitled, but not willing or able to work for themselves and to produce for themselves, how this is generation by generation beginning to erode the very nature and fabric of our civilization.
Right. Now, you said you are the only non-progressive English professor you know about. I was going to ask you a very open-ended question. How's that going for you in the second decade of the 21st century? But I'll specify a little bit. You made some news, I think it was just at the beginning of this school year, by issuing a contract you wanted students to sign before they took your class. I think this was actually the first time I heard your name. Can you talk a little bit about that contract and what the backstory was?
Yeah, you know, with every year that goes by, I teach Shakespeare and I teach a lot of classic literature. I teach the Bible, I teach Greek mythology, I teach Dante and Milton. So I teach basically the dead white males, the great mm-hmm. Western classics. And with every year that goes by, it becomes harder to do it because kids don't want to sit there and listen to the cultures. We are teaching these kids to hate Western culture. And so I'm trying to teach them Shakespeare, and Shakespeare's worldview is very different than ours. And so I'm trying to get them to suspend their own prejudices. I'm trying to get them to put aside their politics, to put aside their 21st century progressive values and try to understand another culture. And so it was becoming harder and harder because kids can't do it. They don't know how to read the books anymore. And they're wedded to their race, class, and gender worldview. And so in order to teach these classes, I came up with a contract that kids signed the first day of class. And that contract basically goes through a number of points. Point number one, that free speech is guaranteed, that if we allow people to be censored, then we can't have an open discussion. They have to sign on to the fact that they're willing to engage in free speech. I remind them in this opening contract that the people we're going to be reading were dead long before you were born. And it is an act of colonialism. How about that? It's an act of actual colonialism to force old books to say modern things. So if you're approaching Shakespeare's work through a 21st century feminist lens, or you're reading Paradise Lost by John Milton through a Marxist lens, you are doing something that is culturally wrong. You are forcing our contemporary values back on old books. And so we're not going to do that in my class. And so I make them sign and initial a number of statements like that as a foundation, right? If you're going to stay in this class, we have to be able to take these people seriously. I am going to, as the professor, I am going to play devil's advocate. I'm going to try to explain their culture to you and defend it. If you are offended by that, you have to drop the class. I think I say you must drop the class 15 different times. If you feel like you're entitled to tell somebody else what they can and can't say, you got to drop my class. If you insist on taking books and judging them by 21st century progressive litmus tests, you have to drop my class, and on and on and on.
All right, two follow-up questions. First of all, can you, I don't know if you can go into this or not, but can you talk about maybe just a couple of the highlights, incidents that led to the creation of this contract?
Well, a couple of years ago, I had a student. We were reading C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. We're doing The Lord of the Rings. We were doing Lewis's work. And these, of course, are two mid-20th century Christian writers. They both have deeply Christian beliefs, and it bleeds into their work. We were reading C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, his three books on Christian science fiction. And a student got really angry with me. She actually filed a formal complaint with the university, and she accused me of political harassment, literally. Mm-hmm. I was harassing her because she was a Democrat, a political Democrat. And she was mad that Lewis's worldview was much more conservative. And so simply by reading the books and not me, and the fact that I didn't rip them to shreds, that I didn't condemn C.S. Lewis, she filed formal political harassment charges against me. What's interesting about that is there is no protection for your political worldview. No university has political protections. No state, the federal government. There is no protected class for your political worldview. You would think the university, which is what my lawyer sent a letter to the university and said, you can't even investigate Dr. Pesta for this because there is no university, state, or federal provision that protects somebody's politics from being offended. Mm-hmm. And yet the university went ahead and did a very costly 4-month investigation of me that ultimately went nowhere, but it was just incredibly disruptive. And to tell you the truth, here I am today, even with my contract. And just last Friday, I had another student formally accused me just Friday of last week of discriminatory harassment because the books and the plays that we're reading in Shakespeare, she refused to distinguish between me explaining Shakespeare's world and her world. So everything I said about 16th century culture, she found offensive to her as a feminist, as a female, as a LGBTQ ally. And so now the investigation starts again. So it just goes to show you that and she signed the contract, by the way. So the contract itself is certainly no guarantee that you're going to get kids who actually want to study.
Okay. So I've speculated from afar this whole social justice war that we've watched unfold on college campuses over the last 5 or 6 years, even though I know that it has roots that go back much further than that, is a useful barometer to understand the politics of this generation and the politics they've been indoctrinated with. But the kinds of behaviors that you're describing, I would still have to think that this is a small minority of students. You know, on my show, I think this is true with a lot of conservative and libertarian media, that college problems have almost become a form of entertainment at this point. Like the presentation that colleges have basically been converted into insane asylums by progressives and postmodernists. And we try to talk about solutions, mostly criticizing schools from the outside and, you know, presenting alternatives. But there you are, you're inside, you can see this every day, approaching 30 years of experience for you. Can you confirm that I am right, that this is a small minority making a lot of noise?
Well, it's a small minority of kids who are the ones forcing investigations on professors, the small minority of kids who are occupying buildings and demanding concessions and demanding that Western culture's got to go and demanding the pulling down of statues. It's a fairly small group that's doing it, but that doesn't change their impact because the universities themselves at the administrative and faculty levels are so deeply steeped in radical leftist politics that they always cave in to the 5%, right? 95% of kids on a typical college campus are probably pretty apolitical, or at least their politics doesn't get in the way of them listening to other people.
Right.
But the problem is that the universities they study in are all as far left as you can get. And so consequently, when this 3 or 5% of kids protest, this is not something the university looks down on it. They encourage it. They want it. The faculty are mobilizing this 5% to completely destroy every last vestige of constitutional values or traditional Western culture or our Judeo-Christian roots. So in other words, this 3% is the Frankenstein monster of the entire monolithic progressive nature of the universe. These are the kids that are unleashed on the campus. And so that's why these administrators are so eager often to give in to them, because it's what the faculty wants. It's what the administrators want. So while it is comical in a way, and it is just a very small number of kids. The fact remains is that the damage that's being wrought culturally and civically in our country because of these kids who've been graduating is staggering. You know, if only millennials had voted, we'd have Hillary Clinton winning 49 states. That's how that's how seriously the progressive left has control over the ideological and political voting rights or voting patterns of people who've graduated from school in the last 15, 20 years.
I'd also like to hear your comment on, you know, that 95%+ of students who are not making a lot of noise and a lot of fuss. You know, my argument going back 10 years as a former public school student and a former teacher in a variety of capacities is that if school has three hidden lessons, the lower levels of school, K through 12, public school, it's obedience, conformity, and those two things, which is like the outsourcing of a lot of personal responsibility in those two lessons, leads to a lot of philosophical, political, social apathy.
Exactly. One of the things I've spent the last 8 years doing is, even in spite of my being a university professor, is I fought Common Core. I could see 8 years ago, 9 years ago, that what the so-called Common Core curriculum in pedagogy, it was nothing more than taking what's wrong with the universities, this focus on social justice at the expense of all else. And now that was dragging it into the high school, the middle schools, and the elementary schools. Hmm. So effectively now, over the last 10 years, we've taken that same myopic focus on social justice. And with that, by the way, with the focus on social justice education, real education has begun to suffer across college campuses. We are no longer giving kids in college a real college education. We're giving them instead a highly ideological, watered down, a progressive education designed to alter the way kids behave, not necessarily prepare them for real life. And what Common Core did, and goals, and to a certain degree, No Child Left Behind, and Goals 2000 before that, what these big federal programs did, whether there's Republicans and Democrats behind them, both are guilty. What Common Core did is it took that same social justice method and it replaced traditional learning in our elementary and primary schools. So kids now, as young as 5 and 6 year old, are getting primarily a social justice education first, and an education relatively weak in reading skills, literacy skills, math skills, and science skills. That's why we're seeing so many cases across the country of transgenderism being pushed on 5 and 6 year olds, of kids as young as 7 or 8 in elementary and middle school being exposed to radical forms of sexual, not just biology of sex, but sexual behavior and mores. The radical leftism in the history curriculum. Our kids, why do we have college kids who now want to pull down statues of Robert E. Lee and pull murals off of school walls that depict George Washington? We have college kids doing that now because for the last 10 years, they were in public schools, elementary, middle, and high schools, where they were taught that the founding fathers were simply criminals, that that no one who fought for the Confederacy could be noble in any way, that they're just the enemy, the racists. Because we've been teaching kids this for a dozen years now, you're now seeing the fruit of that with these radical college kids who don't know much history, but they want everything torn down.
Okay, so let's go a step deeper and talk about the great books of the Western world versus postmodernism, right? Because you wrote a book a few years ago called The Renaissance and the Postmodern, a Study in Comparative Critical Values. Are you familiar with the work of Stephen Hicks?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm paraphrasing him. I don't remember exactly what he said, but he called this like the politics of resentment, something very similar. That phrase captures what he was presenting about it. So let's go back, you know, a few decades to the embrace of the postmodern ideology in higher education through the work of people like Foucault and maybe more specifically Derrida. And in the beginning, it looks like perhaps an interesting and worthwhile exploration, right? The process of deconstructing things and asking what they're all about, asking what their meaning is. But I would argue, and I wanted to know if this has been your finding, when you couple this with the frustration and angst of young people, if that maybe worthwhile purpose originally of deconstruction just turns into a justification for destroying things, and that's kind of picking up from your ripping murals off the wall and tearing down statues. If this is just about a sort of wholesale and reckless, unthinking destroying of what is without thinking too much more about what it means.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I the school of resentment's a great phrase. I think it actually goes back to Harold Bloom. Bloom is a professor of English at Yale University. He's got to be like 100 years old now. And Bloom actually was one of the guys in the 60s and 70s who began to bring in as a professor all of that left-wing, you know, socialist jargon, all of the deconstructionism, all of the Derrida, the Foucault. 40, 50 years ago, Harold Bloom brought it in. And then by the mid-1980s, he had recognized that he'd unleashed a monster. Literally, what you just said happened, that we lost what few redeeming aspects there were to these ways of reading books, and it became nothing more than a wrecking ball. The whole idea, and we should also point out that these French theorists, people like Lacan and Derrida and Foucault, they've been absolutely rejected by French academicians. The French don't take them very seriously. They're not considered serious thinkers in Europe. Yet here in America, we have completely bought hook, line, and sinker the nastiness of this. And you hit it on the head. Deconstruction is nothing more Derridian deconstruction. It just teaches kids how to inviolate text. It teaches kids that all texts are the same text. There's not a lick of difference between Shakespeare's plays and a Victorian grocery list that some maid scribbled on a piece of paper. As a matter of fact, in the interest of politics, the Victorian maid and her scribbling for a grocery list is more relevant to the development of feminism than anything Shakespeare could write was. And so in some ways, it's a superior text. What Derrida did and all of those postmodern and post-structuralists philosophers did was it basically destroyed meaning. It doesn't create anything. It doesn't advance civilization. It just systematically pulls the foundation of 2,000, actually 5,000 years of Western culture. It uproots it. It argues that science, and that's why you've got professors now who are making the argument that the empirical method, the scientific method, is a vestige of white supremacy. That in mathematics, we're being told, our kids are being told on college campuses, that the emphasis on white right answers in math, correct answers in math, is a vestige of white supremacist culture. We learn now that reading the great men of history, right? George Washington, who of all the founding fathers is perhaps in some ways the tamest of them. The left has taken the longest to come for him because he, of course, was the founder of the country. But now, you know, now Washington is being viewed as a terrorist. The professors call him a terrorist, siding with Britain. Britain was the home country. And so by rebelling against Britain, how is George Washington different than the terrorist we keep branding Middle Eastern peoples with? And so this kind of stuff, it doesn't create knowledge. It doesn't advance knowledge. It's just a tool used by professors and now by students to discount everything that might actually give them second thoughts. You know, I'm being a little long-winded, but I'll end my comment by saying this. Under social justice and going back to social justice education, going back to the figures you mentioned, this turn that came 30, 40 years ago to postmodernism, critical thinking now has been subordinated. Critical thinking, which means getting kids to think critically and deeply about a lot of different ideas, exposing kids to the long march of ideas through Western culture, that's dead. That is absolutely dead. We're giving kids now just a very superficial education in, like you said, how to pull books apart. We're giving them just a little bit of feminism. We're giving them a little bit of Marxist dialectic. And then we're turning them loose on the whole of Western culture that they no longer have to read. Because I'm a Marxist or a feminist or I'm a progressive, even to read Mark Twain or to read Shakespeare or to read the Bible now is an act of conformity with racism, sexism, bigotry, and homophobia. So the big trick of the modern age is we've got kids to hate every aspect of our culture without ever having read or studied it. That's a great trick. And the progressives know, if you let kids read Shakespeare, 9 times out of 10, they'll prefer Shakespeare to your theorizing. If you let them study the colonial period, they will recognize the genius of the American founding fathers much more so than if you don't and just fill the kid's head with all these stupid lies.
There's so many roads we could go down from there. A couple of thoughts that come to mind. 2017, I befriended a political science professor at Dartmouth University. I used to live up there in New Hampshire. And she was quite upset in the meetings when they were talking about, I forget, it was some kind of freshman seminar that usually dealt with the big problems or the big questions of philosophy. So she had proposed this unit on Hegel, or that the entire seminar be about Hegel as one of the most influential philosophers of the 19th century. She was shot down by people who said this needs to be swapped out. This isn't relevant anymore. And this seems like it's par for the course from most of what I'm hearing for a seminar on intersectionality. And the other option was fascism as a way to target Trump, right?
Yeah, and fascism, of course, is always a right-wing movement to these people. And what you brought up there is really astounding. When you think about who Hegel was in the 19th century, we would not have postmodernism if it weren't for Hegel. It was Hegelian dialectic, Hegel's reading of Kant, that really opened the door for Marxism and deconstruction and radical progressive politics when it comes to academic inquiry. I mean, it was Hegelian dialectic that opened this up. In many ways, I think that Hegel gave us a reading of Kant that is not necessarily true to what Kant says, but it does. It gave rise to Nietzsche, right? Nietzschean anti-ethic. And so the fact that somebody as redoubtably left as Hegel is no longer considered a fit subject for a seminar in philosophy, we have to go much, much farther left and more radical now than that. That sums up very nicely where we are at this moment in the 21st century.
But even just in very plain and simple language, like left Hegelians and right Hegelians, Hegel went in so many different directions, influenced so many aspects of philosophy that followed him. The idea of his erasure, I found disturbing. This woman who had put, 20 years of work into this pursuit found it far more disturbing than I did. The other part of what you said was about critical thinking. And I remember I've been doing the show maybe 3 years. I was doing a live radio program back in 2012. Somebody sent me some show prep. It said, Texas conservatives move to get rid of critical thinking in the schools. And it was from some garbage, BuzzFeed or whatever. So I said, okay, it's at least worth a look. And my BS detector was not then what it is now. So I said, all right, well, let's see. No one could be this bold that they're just saying, let's get rid of critical thinking. What it turns out they were protesting against in Texas was outcomes-based education, where critical thinking had basically been rebranded as like effective parroting of attitudes curriculum. Do you know what this is about? Where a lot of these standardized tests that kids are taking in school that were related to the development of outcomes-based education that people were warning about as far back as the 90s, maybe before in some cases, that they were not testing kids for knowledge. They were testing kids for attitudinal outcomes.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's a dead giveaway, right? When you call it outcome-based education, what you're basically saying is socialist modes of education. Think about socialism as an ideology, right? Socialism doesn't care whether you work hard or not. Socialism doesn't care if you're talented and intelligent or stupid and lazy. The bottom line of socialism is that we don't measure human achievement based on what you put into it. We just want everything to come out the sausage grinder the same. So the rich man and the poor man, the smart man and the lazy man, the intelligent man and the it doesn't matter. When it's all said and done, we apply to the outcome, right? So the guy who has more, the guy who's earned more, the guy who's tried more, we take from him what he has and we spread it out. And those who don't try as much get as much, right? We level that. That's called outcome-based economics, right? That's the socialist.
Well, that's an interesting take on it. I always thought it was kind of a marketing response to like the scrutiny that the public education got really through the Reagan administration in the 1980s, where it's like, look, all this money is being dumped into this. It doesn't produce anything. And then in the early 90s, they show up with outcomes-based. Okay, we're focused on outcomes now for a change in public education.
Right. And the problem with that is that these big standardized tests with which we measure kids, they don't tell working teachers anything. You're going to give 65 million school kids effectively the same exam. Right. That exam or those tests can't tell a working teacher who's got 25 kids in her class anything meaningful. It's too big. And that's the same problem we have with standards. When you're going to apply one standard of education in math or reading or science to all the school kids in the country, and then judge the success of the program and whether or not the kids get to the standard, is exactly the wrong way to go about it. The best way, kids are not this is treating kids as a collective, right? This is treating kids, and this is again is socialism. This is treating kids or treating culture collectively. making no accounting for the individual differences, and they're very nakedly individual differences, between how kids learn and what kind of things they can learn. Not every kid is going to be as good at math as he is as English, or is going to be able to write as well as they can do science. And so rather, America became a superpower on the backs of men and women who learned in one-room classroom, one schoolroom classrooms, where you had kids being taught as individuals, kids being allowed to become very, very good at that which they were naturally good at, and moderately educated in everything else. That's what we want in an education system, of kids to find out where their strengths are, of kids to be encouraged. If a third grader can read at a 10th grade level, let them read at a 10th grade level. But nowadays, you can't do that because that's not socially just. Why should your kid, who's gifted in math, be able to skip four classes in math and work higher when my kid can't? That's not fair. Your kid has an unfair advantage from Mother Nature. He's doing 11th grade math in fourth grade, but that's not socially just to the kids who can't do that. So let's artificially hold down high achieving kids to close the gap between them and kids who can't perform. That's literally what's happened in the last 25 years. We've given up trying to raise the lowest performing kids, and we're now holding down the highest ones. We're not trying to fix education. We're trying to level it off. We're not trying to improve the ways we teach kids to read, to write, and to do math. We're trying to lower them so more kids can get a low level of education. Right. And that's what this outcome-based education has done.
So before Common Core was even a thing, I was working as an academic service provider, basically just doing tutoring for, it started with, and I got away from this because I didn't like being the police of the school, but I would go in and I would work with kids who were getting C's and D's, right? And parent, mom and dad decided that was a problem and it needed to be remediated. So I remember this one boy, he's 12 years old, he was in middle school, and his math abilities were off the charts. He was so bored in class that the way he solved this problem for himself is he would do all his work in his head, and then he would say to his teacher, look, I can explain what I did, I can show you what I did, but this makes it fun for me. And what he was told, and I talked to the teacher, I had a conference with the teacher to try and solve this problem. He just needs to do what I say. I don't care about anything else. Now, that's a paraphrase, but that was basically the gist of our conversation. I took this information to his mother, who was practically in tears over the situation. And she goes, well, I guess we just need to do what the school says or what the teacher says. And I said, look, what makes you think this woman knows anything? She certainly doesn't know anything about your son, you know, and his abilities and what's happening in this classroom and him, this punitive outcome is hurting him. It's hurting his interest in math. It's hurting his academic confidence. And you know, I mean, I tried to intervene the best I could, but parents are very obedient in these situations too. And they often become enforcers for the bad practices of teachers who are really just obedient to bad policy, I think.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And what you just described about that young kid who could do math is exactly what I said moments ago, right? Yeah. That right. Here you got a kid who's intrinsically good at math, but they're not letting him be good at math. They're forcing him to consider mathematics through a number of different paradigms that are non-mathematical. If you take a kid who's good at math, he's really good at numbers, he's got a lot of that in his head to begin with, and then you force him to do things like write paragraphs about math or use artistic drawings to frame math, you are destroying in him that which makes him math. It would be like teaching, you got a kid who's really good at reading, right? And in order to push that kid down so that he doesn't read any better from his peers, it would be like teaching kids to read, but then imposing a mathematical framework on reading. Okay, so you can read, you're a fourth grader, you're reading at an 11th grade level, but we want you now to read from a numerical perspective. Try to translate those words into numbers. And what would happen? What would happen is the kid is really good at reading, is now suddenly frustrated, unable to do it. What innate ability he has, the gift he has to be able to read at a high level, has been completely thwarted by a program that is getting in the way. And that's what you just described here. I mean, it's classic. This is a classic endpoint of outcome-based education. And notice how cynical it is. Yeah. Rather than treat your kids as individuals, right, who can then find themselves, critical thinking and individuality go hand in hand. Critical thinking means you teach kids to read a lot of different perspectives, to read a lot of different viewpoints, to read a lot of different narratives, and then let them critically decide by comparing and contrasting which ones they believe. Right. We don't do that anymore. What we do is we hand them the worldview we expect them to believe. We freeze out ideas that don't reinforce our progressive social justice values. We only give them those. And then we spend a lot of time in class deriding any ideas that would oppose our social justice worldview. So they don't get to read the Founding Fathers, but they're told the Founding Fathers are bigots, sexists, and racists. And that's what education, in other words, education has become, as you mentioned very early in our talk here, it's become nothing more than an indoctrination on these issues.
Right. And if you can repeat that back as a student, you are now a critical thinker by critical thinking's new definition.
Yep. And you get all the cookies in class and you get promoted to the next level, even if you can't read.
Right. And that was my discovery from pursuing this news article back in 2012 about Texas trying to remove critical thinking. That was what they were after, that level of indoctrination. So we got all of that conversation out of one question. That's pretty good. I had a follow-up to the first question. Was there any fallout or consequences from your issuing of this contract to students at the beginning of the year?
You know, when it broke nationally, Glenn Beck did a story on it, and the College Fix picked it up. I was on Fox News. It was all over the place. Mm. So an associate dean at the university I teach at sent a brusque note to my department head and said, get me a copy of this so-called contract that PESTA is circulating.
Right.
So she emailed me. I had to email her the contract. She sent it to the dean's office. I have no doubt they sent it to UW-Madison. We're part of the UW-Wisconsin system. Madison is the hub. I have no doubt that this associate dean forwarded to the lawyers at UW-Madison. And the fact that I've heard nothing back in almost a year suggests that they probably haven't found anything for which they could censor me. So I assume that the contract is okay. But as I mentioned to you, I mean, it doesn't mean that just because I have a contract and kids sign it doesn't mean they're not going to be idiots when they hear something they don't like, is what happened to me last Friday.
So let's go in a different direction, because what I realized from checking out your show over the last couple of weeks, with the Dr. Duke show, you are pretty much the only other person I've found in the world who's doing something very similar to what I've done with this project for the last 10 years, which is consistently pursuing problems in school and higher education and talking about solutions to those problems. So we talked a little bit about the history of the public system in America. You just mentioned it in passing. Where do you feel like, you talked about the one-room classrooms, where do you feel like this whole project went wrong? Was there one point, were there several points where it was wrong and then it got worse? But if you were in an elevator and someone says, hey, public school's great, and maybe it's a 30-story building that you're going up, what would you tell them?
You know, the entire conception of a state or federal run education program is the problem.
Right.
There's a reason the founding fathers made no provision for public schools in the Constitution or the founding documents, because the founders knew that if you put any kind of a government in control of kids' education, inevitably the government would start educating kids for its benefit and for its politics, not for the families or the local communities or not for their own welfare.
Yeah, there were probably examples of that in the world at that time.
Absolutely.
Certainly,
well,
Sparta.
The American school system in the 1850, Horace Mann begins the process of putting together American public schools. So a good 80 years after the founding of the country. And Horace Mann actually looked around the world to find the perfect model for what he wanted American schools to be. Horace Mann even says that we expect your children to be hostages to our cause. That's the word he used. Once we create this system of public education, he said, the American public will give their children to us as hostages. And the model that he picked was the authoritarian model of 19th century Prussia. Prussia was, of course, a large region of Germany. It was highly militaristic. In many ways, it sort of prefigured the Nazi era. A lot of public boarding schools, kids were moved from the parents' homes very early, given a federalized and nationalized education that turned them into good little soldier warriors for the state. That's the model that Horace Mann picked for the American public school system.
Do you know, I only found this out a couple of years ago, do you know that he never even saw, I mean, this was actually a typical thing. And one of the projects at that time was to go around and look at who were existing or emerging economic competitors to the U.S. and what are they doing? So France was sending people into Central Europe. The British were doing it. Of course, the Americans were doing it, and they would issue these traveler's reports. So Horace Mann went there. He never even saw the schools in session. He toured empty buildings.
Yeah, that's right. He never saw it because for Horace Mann, American public schooling was not to be about knowledge.
Right.
It was a way of separating parents from children, reformatting what the social lives and behaviors and impulses of kids. It was about using the power of government to make kids useful to the state. It was never, and you jump ahead to today, Common Core.
Right.
It's exactly the same thing. Common Core was never meant to be an educational paradigm that increased your kid's reading knowledge or made your kid a better scientist or prepared your kid better for math in college. It was never about that. It was the same thing after 150 to almost 200 years that Horace Mann was arguing for, right? It was about how do we socialize kids? How do we take kids away from their parents and break the bond and break their religious background and break the local control of schools to federalize education, to standardize it, to make it more outcome-based, to make it more standardized test-focused, and to use it as a way of, again, promoting what the federal government considers and some of the state governments consider to be social justice. We're going to break down the barriers between, we're going to make every kid the same kid. At the risk of destroying creativity and individualism, our job as educators, this is the modern world now, this is Common Core, our job is to force kids to become the same kid. Kids who know more than other kids, kids who have advantages of rich parents who can afford tutors, we've got to hold everything down now so that we're graduating kids with exactly the same knowledge. And that's the thing, we know this for a fact. If you're going to get everybody to the exact same standard when it comes to education, by definition, it has to be a low standard because every time you raise the standards one degree, kids fall off at the bottom. So the standardized education we're choosing is basically lowest common denominator education. How many kids, how low do we have to bring the educational bar so that most or all of American kids can say they have an education? It's got to be very low. And that's exactly what we're doing.
I've also noticed, I mean, my relationship with public school began in 1983, and in that time, it seems like there's almost a kind of compound dumbing down effect because one generation of students becomes the next generation of teachers. And you actually talked about this recently on your show. You were looking at what is missing from teacher education. It really resonated with me. So I think they were using Alabama as a case study.
Kentucky
as a case study. But I was, you know, doing teacher training. This was about 12 years ago in the very sophisticated state of Massachusetts, right? So working with college students in Boston, Massachusetts, could it even get more sophisticated when it comes to the next generation of teachers? And, you know, I worked for this tutoring company and they really had their ear to the street on a lot of the struggles the college kids were having and looking for opportunities for us to get new clients. And there was a group of colleges called the Colleges of the Fenway, a bunch of liberal arts schools, but they all had several of them anyway, had teacher training programs. She said, can you go into this school and tutor these teachers to take the certification exams? A lot of money was dangled in front of me to do this, so I studied up on it, and I said I could do it. And then I remember one day in 2007, sitting in the Wheelock College Library, and I am petrified. I'm about to meet a group of women who were finishing up the certification study program at the college, and I was going to tutor them to do well in the certification program. I said, I'm going to be found out. I'm a fraud. I shouldn't be doing this. I didn't prep enough for this. I was encountered by a group of people who knew absolutely nothing about what they were going to be teaching, about the practices of elementary ed, about American history, about American literature. And I was stunned that these people were going into the school, at best, these blank slates. But then I was listening to, it was episode 60 of your podcast, and now it sounds like there's, and we've talked about this, but it's also a nice way for us to finish today. There is this whole layer on top of that blank slate, that nothingness of knowledge that they had, which is this political agenda that they're going into the schools to basically infect these kids with.
Yes. And, yeah. And I remember when I started teaching college 25 years ago as a graduate teaching instructor at Purdue University in Indiana. 25, 30 years ago, my kids came to me ignorant. They didn't know much. They had not read much. They didn't understand much. But they were humble. There was a certain humility.
Yes.
These kids came to college and they knew they didn't know things and they felt bad about it. They kind of wanted to learn things. Fast forward 25 years. The kids are coming to me now much, much more ignorant than they were 25 years ago, much at a much lower level than they were 25 years ago. But they're coming to class with a serious political attitude, that the attitude that they shouldn't have to read things from our racist past. They're entitled to get degrees, whether they do the work or not. That even the math and science, even this abiding idea that somehow that even if they can't do the work, they should be passed. The idea of, because they've been socially promoted their whole lives, that you can't hold me responsible because I can't do the math. I'm here. I was allowed into college. That means I'm ready for this. You have to lower your standards. And we're seeing universities across the country lowering standards because we keep admitting kids who don't belong.
So silver lining in the end here, have you found effective ways, at least in some cases, to mediate when you encounter this entitlement or these attitudes with your students?
Well, you know, even this elaborate contract that I've had them sign doesn't protect you. I mean, they still continue to complain. I think I would have had a lot more complaints, though, if I have not been very diligent in my classes of stressing. Look, before we can study this material, we have to understand why we're studying it. So what I've done is create layer after layer after layer of walking them down the road to understanding before we even begin. 25 years ago, guys, when I started teaching Shakespeare, I taught 11, 12, 13 plays a semester. Mm-hmm. 13. Now I'm teaching 4 in an upper division English class because it's all they can handle. I can't do more. I literally, to some degree, these graduating juniors and seniors, I actually teach them how to read. I'll give them a simple passage of Shakespeare, which for a senior English major should not be that complicated. And I'll ask them, they can't read it. So I have to help them locate the subject and the verb so they can begin to understand it. So what I do is I recognize that they are handicapped, that they are semi-literate college kids. They have no historical background and they've been taught that everything is political. So the first couple of weeks of class, before we even really dig into Shakespeare, I start asking them questions and pushing them in the right way and breaking down some of these intellectual fences that their other schooling has put up to prime them to be able to begin to read Shakespeare. And because I've done that, when we encounter strange ideas in Shakespeare, they're more prepared for it. And yet, nevertheless, pretty much once a year, I get one kid who goes off the rails because it's so different from what she was taught. And she runs and complains that, I'll give you one example before we sign off. One of the things I was accused of in this latest round was Dr. Pesta says that marriage is a religious contract between a man and a woman. That's her piece of evidence how I offended her. Now, that's a perfectly valid opinion. You may disagree with it, you may not, but it's a perfectly valid opinion, even if it was my opinion. And yet that was offensive to her. And what she left out was, I said that in the context of Shakespeare's world. In Shakespeare's world, there is no doubt that marriage was a religious contract between a man and a woman. But she couldn't distinguish what I was talking about in Shakespeare's time from what she believes. So because Shakespeare's world believed that, and I repeated it, she considered that me harassing her and accused me of this to the university.
Well, it's a predictable outcome of the erasure of the great conversation, too, right?
Yep.
Where there's such a presence of a clash of ideas, hence the great conversation, one great mind responding to the next. When that framework is missing from somebody's education, you could see how suddenly another opinion could be just catastrophic, and that's a shame. So we talked about, 5% of what you and I could have talked about today. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing your presentation at the Red Pill Conference. And maybe if you have a chance, we could sit down there and continue this conversation.
We can, or if you ever need me back on your podcast, I'd be happy to come back. Just let me know. If you're interested out there in this kind of discussion, consider downloading the Dr. Duke Show podcast. It's drdukeshow.com, and listen to what we have to say.
Awesome. And do you have a website where people can find all your work?
Freedom Project. It's FPEUSA.org. It's Freedom Project. FPEUSA.org.
All right, Duke, thank you so much. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Hope to talk to you soon. Thank you. Everybody.